My name is Clancy Emmerslund, and I'm an alcoholic. I almost didn't come up here. I wasn't listening to the first part of his talk, and that's all there was to it. But people around here are getting action. I just kind of wish I had a cup of coffee.
What do you want to
know? Sit down, Dick. I've already dispatched her. Thank you. Don't put your finger in, it'll get too sweet. I'm very glad to be here tonight. I'm glad to be safe and sane and sober, as I'd like to say, because I didn't used to be, and I may not be again sometime, because it happens to people like me. But it doesn't happen much if they're doing what they're supposed to be doing. I'm very glad to be here at the Southern version of this particular convention and to see the old friends here speaking. Bob, his charming wife, we spoke together 2 weeks ago, wasn't it? And my story has changed a lot since then. I've just come into the knowledge that I may be the illegitimate son of Dr. Bob and Sister Ignatia. Give me a little spiritual cachet, don't you think? And Marie, who I talk to every week, she tells me how cold it is in Canada, and I hang up. Who cares? Who cares? But Bob and I were just in Spain together last week. We talked in Spain, and that's really... that's a thrill, you know, you pour out your heart and they say, caramba! What the hell does that mean? I don't know. But we went to see the Rock of Gibraltar. That was kind of fun. And it saw it rain 3 days. I think I must be carrying the rain seed with me, because I went there, it rained, the first time they ever had 3 days of rain in a row, ever. Came back to California, broke the drought there with 5 days of rain. Came here tonight. Look at that poor hunchback girl. Aren't you supposed to be out ringing the bell? And then I got here today a little bit tired because I had to work all week, unlike some of the other speakers. And I'm kind of tired. And then they put kind of a fast one on me. They told me the name of my topic is The Gift of Purpose. What the hell does that mean? I called the New York office immediately. And they gave me a real good New York answer. They said, huh? But I'm very glad to be here. And I think the gift of purpose really is, there is a reason for it. And just for a few minutes, I'd like to talk just a little bit off, away from my story. We all know that Bill Wilson, when he had this apparent spiritual experience in the town's hospital, and he came out of there and felt he'd been assigned by God to help drunkards. He had a mandate to help drunkards. And he went to the Oxford Group. A lot, I'm sure there's some here, people who don't know who the Oxford Group is, I'll tell you. In the late, about 1908, there was a Lutheran minister up in Pennsylvania that felt Christianity was getting too loose. People weren't surrendering enough to it, not dedicated. First century, God, the people would be crucified and burned alive and give up for their faith. And now you couldn't even get them to come to church when it rained, you know. We're losing it. So he started an organization called the First Century Christian Association. And he talked it up and didn't get a lot of takers, you know. No, I don't think I want to be crucified this year, Reverend. Or maybe next year. But after the First World War, he went to Europe and traveled around, went to England and France and tried to talk it up. And nobody cared much about it, except the students at Oxford University thought it was just wonderful. They just took it up and, isn't that great? That's what we need. So much so that it became known as the Oxford Group. And he brought it back here in the late 1920s. Now we had the imprimatur of the or the approval of the Oxford University. So there were Oxford groups set up all over the United States. Almost every city had one, but in a completely different form than he had envisioned. It really, in what it turned out to be, is better type people getting together in each other's homes and discussing how they could more effectively gain spiritual growth. And that's what it was. It was kind of a religious. They talked a lot about Jesus and how they could overcome their resistance to spirituality. And that's where Bill Wilson wound up after he got out of the hospital, because Ebby was in the Oxford group. And the reason he was in the Oxford group is because the guy that worked with him was in the Oxford group, the guy that went to France or Switzerland, Roland. But anyway, he got to the Oxford group and he wanted to help people. So he went to Oxford group meetings almost every day for 6 months, and he'd pick up street drunks on the way, poor bastards, and bring them there. These people, you know. I believe you're throwing up on my shoes, sir. And it just shocked everybody. And he'd take him home and work with him and tell him about Jesus. And they didn't want to hear it. And nobody ever stayed sober. One guy committed suicide in his house to show his disfavor with it all. A little strong reaction, I thought. But he got up one day after about 6 months of this, and he went to get a cup of coffee, and he realized the guy he brought home last night was not here, and the coffee pot was gone. So he probably took it to pawn it for a drink. And his wife got up, and she's got a bleary eye, she's tired. She worked in a basement of a cheap department store in the Depression, trying to make a few bucks so that he could pay the rent so he could help drunkards. And he had a terrible sense of guilt and despair. He said, "Oh, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry. I thought I had some sort of mandate to help people, but obviously I don't. I've worked with people for 6 months and not one person has stayed sober, and I'm done with it. I'm not going to do it anymore." And right there, your life and mine hung by a thread about that big. And he said, I thought, sure, I'd have something, message for these people, but they have no message. They're all of them are worse than when I found them. He said, I'm going to get you out of that department store. If I have to get a job shoveling dirt, I'm going to get it out. Honey, I'm so sorry. Because she'd been a society, chic society girl when we married her. Now she's a little old before her time, salt and pepper hair. And what caught his eye was she was putting on her sweater with a patch on the sleeve that this poor girl had sunk to putting wearing that to go to work. And he said, honey, I'm not going to do that anymore. I've tried, and not one person stayed sober. And she turned to him and changed our lives. I had lunch with her about 40 years ago up in Connecticut. I said, how'd you ever think that answer, Lois? God, it really changed our lives. I don't know. Seemed obvious to me. He said, not one person stayed sober. And I said, you did. He said, oh. That's why old timers don't have much hair in front. We go through life that way. Oh, Dick has done it a lot. To no avail, I'm sorry. I said, well, what am I doing wrong? He went down to this doctor friend at Towns Hospital who had told his wife just a few months before that if he comes here again drunk, he's going to be dead because he can't go through another one of these things. And he said, Doc, what am I doing wrong? I'm trying to help these people. I'm sure I've got a reason to help them, and I can't help them. What are you telling them, Bill? He said, I'm trying to teach them to have a spiritual experience. He said, you got no chance at all with that. That's ridiculous. No one's going to hear you that. You're going to teach them spirituality, and they'll get drunk, don't they? He said, drunks don't respond well to spiritual calls. He said, I can't, and asking me, what are you asking me for? We have no answer for you. You come down here, we know how to get you sober. We put you in the street, and you're back here a month later drunk again. We have no answer. Nobody's got any answer. And because alcoholics seem to be caught up in a deal in which it's almost as though they're living in an invisible shield. And when you give them advice, it just bounces off. Boom, boom. Thank you, I appreciate that. Boom, boom. Thank you, I'll try that next week. Boom. He says, we can't get through to them. They're trapped in a shield that says, but my case is different. And there isn't a person in this room that hasn't carried that badge somewhere a few times. And so he said, I've got an idea. I don't know. It seems odd. I can't use it. But it seems to me if someone would tell these people, well, look, I'm a drunk like you are. I'm not lecturing you. I'm just trying to identify. Maybe you make a little hole in that shield and get something inside. But I can't do it. You can tell them what drinking does for you. You tell me about it. I have no idea what the hell you're talking about because it doesn't do that for me. And you tell me how tough it is to quit. I don't have any problem quitting. It's something that's within the alcoholic, apparently. Why don't you try to tell him that you have had this drinking problem and you apparently have found a way around it and you can help him with it? And Bill said, that's like the stupidest thing I ever heard. What good is it going to do for me to tell some old puke that I'm a drunk? But he went home, said, thanks, Doc. And shortly thereafter, he got a letter from his friends on Wall Street where he used to work. He said, we understand you're staying sober now, Bill. That's good. Glad to hear that, because you really were a mess. Now, maybe you can help us. We got a deal out in Akron, Ohio. We're trying to put together some proxies for this rubber machine tool company. And the people out there don't know what the hell's going on. We're going to send you out there, and you get these proxies together, and we'll take over this company. You'll be president, and you'll be on Easy Street for the rest of your life. And Bill thought, yeah. And he went out there, and of course, as we all know, blew up in his face, wasn't his fault. But they had told him, you know, don't bother coming back if you blow this one, because you're not going to have another chance with us. And it blew up, and he wound up standing on a hot May morning in the lobby of the hotel there. He reached in his pocket, he had a $10 bill. He could either pay his hotel bill or he could buy a train ticket home. He didn't really want to go home because he had left on such a fit of optimism up, and his wife was feeling so good, and he had to slink back in and say, no, I failed again. I never can do anything right. And so he didn't know what to do. But I always like that part of the story. He said, I stood in that hotel lobby, oh, I don't know, about 1969 or so, trying to recreate that feeling, what it would be like. I could recreate it, but I got a sense of what it was like. They later changed it to a senior citizen center. I could identify with it now. But anyway, over here there was a door. And he said, out of that door came the sound of clinking glasses and feminine laughter and music from the jukebox. And he realized something I'm sure every one of us would realize. If I just had a couple drinks, I could think of an answer. And he started, and every step he took, we might as well start making our funeral arrangements. And out of the corner of his eye, he saw across in the lobby, there's some pay phones on the wall. And some of you young folks, used to be big black phones on the wall. And you went like this instead of going. So he remembered he'd promised his friends in the Oxford group that he would not take any big actions without calling someone. So we went over the telephone, and in small town hotels, they used to, I've seen a lot of times, have a sign over the payphones that listed the big churches and their ministers and the phone number. So he called the first number, and man says, hello. He says, my name's Bill Wilson. I'm a rum hound from New York. I got to talk to somebody in the Oxford group. I really need it badly. Can you help me get in touch with somebody? I said, I'm sorry. I don't know what you're talking about. I'm trying to write a sermon. Please, I'm sorry to bother you. Hung up. He called the next number, and nobody answered. He called the next number, and nobody answered. He called the next number, and a nice man on the phone said, I'd like to help you, sir, but I don't know anybody in the Oxford group. It's not in my particular field, but I wish you well. And then he had the feeling, and I'm sure that I would have had it, I presume you would have had it. Well, I did what I said I would. I tried to get a hold of somebody. And he turned away, he saw at the bottom of the list of ministers some strange name. Dick, what was his name?
Tunks.
Huh?
Tunks.
Tunks, Walter Tunks, I know that. This is bad luck water here. So he called Walter Tunks, and Walter said, "Funny you should call." He said, "I remember my congregation who's a very active member of the Oxford group, and she was telling me just this week that they have a doctor in their group that is a terrible drunkard. He admitted it this week for the first time, and he can't. They pray for him, and he doesn't get any better. Maybe I could help you." So she said, "Let me see what I can do." He called her, and she said, "Yes, I'd like to have a talk. Let me talk to Mrs. Smith." So she called Mrs. Smith, and the phone rang and rang and rang. They should have put this in the book. Some old-timer Akron told me about it, and rang. She started to hang up. All of a sudden, "Hello, I'm sorry I was out in the yard. This is Mrs. Smith." She said, "I'd like to, there's a man here from New York who perhaps can help your husband with his drinking. Could we talk to, would your husband be able to talk to him?" He said, "Yeah, oh, I'd love to have him talk to him. He's drunk on the floor right now, he can't get up. But I'll tell you, perhaps you can set up a deal tomorrow. Perhaps you can come out to my house. You bring your doctor out, and I'll get this man out." So she called to Bill Wilson, showed him how to take his streetcar out there. So the next day, which is Mother's Day of 1935, Bill Wilson, kind of apprehensively wondering what kind of deal this is, and goes out in the streetcar to this wealthy mansion. And the Smiths go out, and the doctor and his daughter and his son and his wife go out in a car, and the doctor's too hungover and sick to drive, so he has his 16-year-old son drive. And oddly enough, he came to our program later, years later. He never was an alcoholic, but he married some alcoholics and became the A word. Became an Al-Anon. And in fact, at the International Convention in New Orleans in 1980, I guess, we were all there at the last meeting. Johnny Harris was going to speak, and the chairman was, "We have a special guest in the house, Dr. Bob's son, young Bob Smith." And he walked out. Nobody ever heard of him before, you know. We jumped, clapped, and cheered. And he was so taken by it that he stayed around and went to Al-Anon and became a well-known Al-Anon speaker. He spoke at a lot of conventions. He was a good friend of mine, young Bob. Smitty, they called him. And but one of his great parts of his talk was driving his father out to that meeting that day. He said, "My dad was so sick, and he kept saying to my mother, 'Ann, I'll give this guy 10 minutes. I'm not going to listen to any more damn lectures on my drinking. I know about my drinking. I've been getting lectures and lectures and lectures. I'm sick of it. I'll give this guy 10 minutes, but I'm not going to listen to any more damn stuff. I can't stand it.'" So they get out there and have a small collation, and these two guys wandered off in a room for their 10 minutes and spend there 4 hours. And came out, and the doctor looked different. He said, "My God, Ann, that's the first man I ever talked to who seemed to know how I felt and what a few drinks does for me and how bad it gets when I try to go on the wagon. He said, 'My God, I thought I was the only one in the world, yet I can't believe it.'" He said, "Bill, could you stay around and maybe just a couple weeks we could talk some more, and I think I've got maybe a chance for recovery." And Bill thought, "Let's see. I have nowhere to get out of town. Yes, I can stay." So they sat and talked for a week or two about spiritual values, and Dr. Bob just blossomed. Just felt wonderful. After the second end, near the second end of the week, Bob said, "Bill, I can't tell you how wonderful I feel. I've got a new life. This weekend, if you don't mind, I'd like to have you stay here with my wife and kids in the house. I'm going to go to Atlantic City for the international, or for the National Medical Association meeting, American Medical Association. He said, I was there last year, and I was so drunk, and they ridiculed me and poked fun at me and treated me like a... I'm going to go this year, and I'm going to show them I found something. And I'll be back Tuesday morning. And Tuesday morning, the phone rang early in the morning, and a woman was on the phone and said, Mrs. Smith, I'm so sorry, this is the doctor's nurse. They carried him off the train this morning so drunk he couldn't walk. And the station agent knew that I worked for him, so I came down, and the cab driver have him on the floor of his office here, and he's crying, and he's so sorry. And I'm so sorry, because I know he was trying so hard to do better. I guess there's maybe no help for him. Mrs. Smith came down with, she said, I'll come down with Mr. Wilson, get him. They came out and got him, brought him home. I don't know, very few things in the world more sickening than the crying, sorry drunk. I'm so sorry. Now you're sorry. Boom. You know. But they took him home and they put him in bed. I don't know what happened. So a couple of days passed, and all of a sudden Bill sits up. Dr. Bob sits up. He says, what day is it? He says, Thursday morning, Bob. He says, oh, my God. Oh, my God. I got to do a cancer surgery this morning. I can't hold a knife. Look at my hand. I can't. They'll take my license. I've put this thing off twice already. My God, what do I do? And his wife and his new friend Bill got him up and bathed him and got him dressed, and his new friend Bill got him some beer to steady his hand. Send him off to the hospital. He said, I'll be home about 2 o'clock. And away he went. 2 o'clock came, didn't come back. 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock. Son of a bitch must be drunk again somewhere. But the door suddenly threw open. There's Dr. Bob, cold sober. He said, when I was doing that operation, he said, you know, the Oxford group, they always talk about we should make amends, we should rectify mistakes we've made. But I never thought that applied to doctors. Doctors should be above that. But I realized I'm a human being first. And I'm not a doctor first, I'm a human being first. So I've been all over Akron all afternoon making amends to people. And I feel wonderful. That was June 10th, 1935, which they considered to be the AA birthday. They didn't know it was an AA birthday, just two more pukes sober briefly. But the one thing they learned from that, sitting around talking about religious matters had not kept Dr. Bill sober in New York, but it kept him sober, was trying to help these 6 months of losers. And they had to find somebody they could talk to. And so the doctor said, well, I've got a nurse up there in Hollywood, up the Akron Hospital, and she'll help us, because the big problem in hospitals then, you couldn't go in as a drunk. You had to have a physical problem to get into a hospital. Hypoglycemia, not even hypoglycemia, but some in your plumbing probably. And he called her up. He said, Ignatia, this is Dr. Smith. Do you have anybody up there that... kind of qualifies to be helped with their drinking problem? She said, yes, funny you should ask. We have a doctor, a man here, a lawyer, moved here from Louisville a few years ago to get away from his drinking. Of course, it's been worse. And he's in here for a problem inside of his stomach, but he's a bad drunk. Let me see if I can arrange for you to meet with him. And a guy named Bob D., Bill D. And I heard him talk, 35, 40 years ago. He said, somebody says, I was laying in that bed in Akron, Ohio. And my wife came in and said, two men want to talk to you about your drinking. And I said, absolutely not. I am so sick of people talking to me about my drinking, I could puke. I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to listen to anybody. Leave me alone. He said, but my wife's too. Strong woman. So I talked to those two fellows. And they never talk about what my drinking was. They talk about their drinking and how they felt and what it did for them and all the things that went with it. He said, and I couldn't believe my ears. I would have bet my life I was the only man in the world who had those feelings. So I was so impressed, I've been with him ever since. And he became number three in this tenuous little chain. And they talked it up around town much. Yeah, it was nobody who cares much. But one little side light that I always like to talk about, because it brings tears to my eyes, they got a young guy named Ernie. And he was only 29, so he couldn't be an alcoholic that young. They said, well, you can't be an alcoholic, but you sure drink like one, Ernie. And you can come with us, but don't talk much. And he fell in love with Dr. Bob's daughter and brought our organization its first relationship. But, you know, that happened in my family. My daughter, Susan, fell in love with the guy I sponsored. And I did everything in my power to stop that relationship. But my daughters all know more than I do. Is that fortunate for me? And they told me I didn't understand that they got married. They got married, and I've always used that as an epitome of mixed emotions. Watching your daughter go down the aisle to marry a man whose fifth step you've heard. You can't really say anything and break the sanctity of the fifth step, but you can give a clue. Let me know if he ever brings a sheep home. But Ernie and Dr. Bob started got married. They said, you don't have to go with us anymore. You have to go to the meetings. You have to go to the Oxford group. Stay home, take care of your wife. Stay home, take care of your new home. So he did, and they all were sad. But he got drunk and didn't get sober again for 50 years. Turned her against AA for 50 years, too. But anyway, Bill finally went back to New York and got a few little people gathered around. But the great lesson they had learned was this, that you cannot expect people to learn about sobriety by talking about their drinking. You talk about your feelings and how you're like them and what they understand. And that began the success of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because we forget that sometimes. The only thing that differentiates AA from so many other programs is we identify with the person. We work through that wall. And when you don't identify, it just doesn't get anywhere at all. AA, unless without identification, is just a bunch of another program full of pretty words. Here's all the things we're going to do. We're going to make it all wonderful. But that's not what we're here for. The doctor at Towns Hospital stumbled onto the magic solution. And I think that the point of all this is this. He gave us the gift of purpose. Our purpose is to get through that wall. And we didn't ever know that. And so when you wrote the title for that talk, you thought I'd never have a gift of purpose, didn't you? That's the gift of purpose, folks. I want to thank you very much. I thought it was very clever to get there that way. But what we have in common, again, as usual, as we're all here for one reason, we didn't think we belonged here. We somehow got driven here. And somehow, somewhere along the line, if we were fortunate, someone helped us identify that our case was not as different as we feared. And that's the whole story of Alcoholics Anonymous, the whole growth of it over the years. And that's where it's a funny thing, you know, they had so few people at first, and little by little, one by one, they added to it. Now it's, 2 million some all over the world. Go anywhere in AA, in the country, in the world, I mean, there's an AA meeting. It might not be the type of AA we think about, but it's an interesting thing. I've been to AA a lot of places, and you'd think, except you must be all different in Thailand, must be all different in Rio de Janeiro. in Switzerland, it is really isn't, except for the accents, you hear the same BS you hear in your home group. Just endless justification, rationalizations. That woman's trying to hurt me. Yes, we know that. Because it's an amazing thing, when you get down below the surface, how similar we all are. I was reading a book on the plane on the way in here that went into a little bit of the physiology of alcohol. They didn't quite have it, but they knew that somehow alcohol triggered something in some drinkers. It could be something in their childhood, something, maybe their lineage somehow. But nobody knew why, but some drinkers responded badly to alcohol. By responding badly, it did something that made it more alcohol necessary. And I've often thought that the very reason that I know I'm an alcoholic now is because someone broke through the wall, and I had it going pretty well. I went 10 years in and out of AA all over the country. I'd go to AA when the heat was on, till the heat was off, then I'd get out of here, these losers. And I never really believed I was an alcoholic for one reason. Alcohol is not really my problem. My problem is something I don't even want to talk about. I'm too sensitive. Nobody wants to say that in public. I'm too sensitive. Who are you? And I feel things too intensely. You could hurt my feelings just like that. And I can see rejection where nobody can see rejection. And I think I'm being used a lot. And it's just on and on. And it makes me feel terrible. And somewhere along the line, when I was a young man, I discovered that a few drinks of alcohol soothed it. It was the panacea for it. And I always knew that alcohol is not my problem. Alcohol is my answer. My only problem is I have a tendency to drink too much. I've got to find a way to stop when I get where I'm going. And I guess nobody else ever had that problem. And I read in the book, chapter 3, it talks about what we all have in common. Not much. We have a few things in common. One thing in common is this. We all, somewhere along the line, apparently have accepted, voluntarily or involuntarily, the obsession that somehow, someday I will control and enjoy my drinking. It says the persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity and death. And I know that's true because I've preached a few funeral sermons over people who pushed it into the insanity and death. To think that that's a mark of all of us. I thought I was the only one, like the guy in the hospital in Akron. I never knew there was other people who behind their veneer were feeling sensitive and overcome and had discovered that a few drinks would make it better. Some people didn't do that to them, but they estimate about 1 in 10 drinkers are possibly an alcoholic. And you don't know, all you know is that my gardener can drink. God damn it, I can drink. I'll just got to watch it. Now tonight when I stop for a couple drinks, after 2 I'm going to go home. And all of a sudden it's 1 o'clock. What happened? I asked my sponsor about that. He said, that's very simple to answer, kid. He said, people like us, we respond to alcohol. It changes our perception of reality. And the person that stops in there for 2 drinks is not the same person who just had 2 drinks and now wants a nice time. Let's go, baby! I'm Sam Slick from Slickville, Wisconsin. He said, that's what makes an alcoholic. It does something that takes away the inherent control that you must have in order to stop drinking. And I didn't know that. I said, but how? He explained to me all these things, and I said, Jesus, Bob, I'm not really an alcoholic, though. There's something wrong with me emotionally. I know that. I've been in an insane asylum. They couldn't find it. I've been spent $10,000 in psychoanalysis. They couldn't find it. But there's something wrong inside of me. And if I could just get a handle on that, I'll bet I could have a few drinks and not go up and go away for 5 hours or 10 hours or a week. He said, well, that never will happen, kid. He said, the curse of alcoholism is this. Alcohol must do something special for you that it doesn't do for other people. It's not doing something to you, it's doing something for you. It is literally changing your perception of reality. And he had a cup of coffee in his hand. He said, if this were Johnny Walker, and I took a big drink. The net result would be it would almost instantly change the way things look. A little warmer, a little more pleasant. I used to be able to do that too. Now it doesn't take too much effort. He said, it changes your perception of reality. Alcoholism is truly a disease of perception. And I said, well, okay, I can go along with that. But then I get drunk and get in trouble and I quit. And I quit, and it's so bad. I mean, people say, they just quit. I can't quit. It's worse than quitting smoking. And he pointed that out. That's the other side of the coin. So that's why the first step over there, it says, you have to admit you're having a problem with alcohol. Then there's a dash, which in English language means end of thought, beginning of new thought. You must also admit you're having a problem without alcohol. And if either one of those weren't present in your system, you wouldn't be here. If you could drink, you'd be out drinking. You could stay sober comfortably, go on the wagon, you'd be saying you wouldn't come around here. When you can't get either, you're driven to rooms like this. And you sit there and your head says, what the hell are you doing here? But you have to work through that to start to understand and hear enough identification. Someday you'll hear somebody say things and you'll say, my God, I see it. And I remember saying to him, Bob, the way you talk about it, it's just the way I've been going for 10 years. For 10 years I've been doing that in every city. I got a whole bunch of kids all born in a different part of the country where it's going to be different. And I'm going to be different and have a good job sometimes. Made a lot of money and a lot made no money sometimes. He said, kid, there's a name for people like you. I thought, uh-oh, because he was profane. And he might call me a dirty name. And what would that be, Bob? He said, I believe you're an alcoholic. I said, how could I be an alcoholic when my number one problem is not alcohol? He said, alcoholics aren't people whose number one problem is alcohol. Alcoholics are people whose number one answer is alcohol. If it's your answer, you're screwed. And he told me that in early December of 1958. I thought, what if that's true? What if I'm an alcoholic? How could that be? But just for the hell of it, I'll do what he says for a little while and see if it works out. And I did. Now it's been 50, 60 years, and he's absolutely right as far as I know. But the hardest problem seems to me in Alcoholics Anonymous, the most difficulty anybody ever has is coming to believe they're truly an alcoholic. So I can always raise my hand. Yeah, I'm an alcoholic, but I'm not really. But to discover that you really are an alcoholic, because if you can really believe you're an alcoholic, AA is a snap. Because it's just a series of things you do if you're an alcoholic. But if you're not an alcoholic, they all become make busy, dumb things. Let's write my inventory. Read it to some blabbermouth. I do all these things. But if I'm an alcoholic, these are just things you do. It's like saying if you got a terrible disease that responds to medicine, you take medicine. Nothing to it. You have to argue about it, fight about it. So I guess the greatest message for me and for most anybody I know is coming to believe, even temporarily, that you're really an alcoholic. not just a person with a series of bad breaks who drank a little too much, but not a person who's been victimized by fate, but the fact that alcohol is the best friend I ever had. Friends come and go, lovers come and go, jobs come and go, cities come and go, but when a few drinks is taking a shy, introverted, highly sensitive person and turning him into something. Shit! There's nothing like it in the world. But if it does that, I must die a drunkard's death, unless I'm willing to admit that I've got a problem that I don't think I really have. So that's what we're here for. We keep talking it up in meetings. Come and believe you're an alcoholic. Listen to the speakers. Try to find something you can identify. Yeah, that's me. And on and on. And every time, one day my sponsor told me, I'm not sure I can do these steps all the time. He said, every time you walk into a meeting, you take the first step. That's the action of walking into a meeting. What happens after that comes and goes. But he said, we're not asking you to become a religious freak. We're asking you to believe that there's someone that can talk to you. I remember, I want to thank my friend who drove me from the airport today. We had a difficult time because I was outside and I was at the wrong gate. He said, well, I'm in gate one. I said, I'm in gate two. I'll be right there. Just wait. And so I quickly moved to gate four. But he knew I was going to do it, so he came there. He's some kind of a witch. Anyway, but the interesting fact is that we all have to come to believe we're an alcoholic. To come to believe. And then the steps are simple. Turning things over, all that means is doing what they tell you to do, as far as I can see. And coming to believe in a power greater than myself. I'd had some difficulty when my son died when I was in jail. And I got mad at God and I cursed him. I said, screw you, God! You killed my little boy that never had him commit a sin to punish me because I'm bad. Well, screw you, God, you Norwegian Lutheran old son of a bitch. You'll get me when I'm dead, but you won't get me in the land. So they talked to me about returning to God. That was not a choice for me. He said, well, you're a fortunate kid. Nothing could they ever ask you to return to God. Oh, I said, well, power greater than myself is what. He says, no, does it ever ask you to return to anything? They ask you to come to believe in something. Can you believe in a loving God? I said, no. He said, can you believe in AA? And I said, I like it better than I used to. But not much. He said, you think I'm doing better than you are? Yes. Congratulations. I'm your new higher power. And he saved my life. People ridiculed me and joked about that around that club. He saved my life because I believed that he was trying to help me and I did what he said. And I think the single greatest action that I can remember ever taking, I hadn't thought about this in 50 years. I was talking to some new boob and it popped my mind. When I was about 4 or 5 months sober, I was staying sober, had a little job, got fired soon thereafter, but I had a little job. And there was a woman in AA that I just hated. God, I hated her. She was overpowering, snide. I forgiven her. But when I saw her, I just like run over and put my hands in her throat. Here, try to breathe now, you fat bag. You know. And I went to a meeting one night, and my sponsor said, I want you to go over and apologize to Annie. I said, apologize to her? She's going to kill her. I said, why do you want me to apologize to her? Someone told me that last night at the Ohio Street meeting, you called her a bitch. I said, well, she is a bitch, Bob. Why do you think she's a bitch? She told her new girl to stay away from me. Well, she's right. You apologize. And right there, every fiber of my being thought, enough of this phony AA crap. Apologizing to that old bag. Just embarrass, humiliate me. And I'm not doing anything anyway. I'm living in an abandoned car back at the AA club. This is the rotten, stupidest thing in the world. I'm about to do this. But thank God my feet were honest. And then...
Sorry I called you a bitch.
You bitch. But I believe that was the single most difficult action I took in Alcoholics Anonymous. I look back and think, but nothing doing at all. But if you believe you're an alcoholic, your feet will take care of you. You can't, your mind won't. But now I've stayed sober, and I've had no other therapy except Alcoholics Anonymous. Not say, I know we have probably some people here wondering, maybe measuring other therapies that talk about it. I want to tell you something. I am a comfort seeker. If there were a better way to go, I would be there doing it. I wouldn't be here tonight. I'd be there. And the reason that I'm here is because this is the best and easiest and only way I know for people like me to remember there's a name for my problem and there's an answer to my problem. And all I have to do is do it. And then I won't have to go through life wondering what the gift of purpose really means. Coming. I want to end on one other note. In 1960, I was sober a year and a half. My sponsor made me go to the International Convention, which was held in Long Beach. And Ebby spoke at that convention, the only one he ever spoke at. Sister Ignatius spoke. Just a panoply of leaders. And I listened to Sister Ignatia talk. I was so thrilled. And I rushed up forever and said, "Thank you, Sister Ignatia." And I kissed her on the cheek. I thought, oh my, maybe you shouldn't kiss nuns. And I believe I said, "I'm so sorry, Sister Ignatia. It's all right to kiss a nun." And I think she said, "As long as you don't get in the habit."
All right, we're going to close.